Hey gang, welcome to another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio. Today is Monday. Monday is the day that Mark Collett joins us from across the pond. Mark, how are you doing today?
Very good mood. All ready for an exciting episode of National Bugle Radio, the best way to start your week.
Yes, indeed. Well, before we get going, yesterday, or at least over the weekend, because I don't pay attention to these things, there was the Academy Awards show, which I guess is some cheap Jewish takeoff of the Goyim's Choice Awards. I'm not sure, because I don't pay attention to these things. But one of the films that they were considering was a film by the name of Black KKK Klansman, or something like that, which is a fictitious account of a black police officer from Colorado infiltrating the KKK, and which was had some plot to, what was it, kill a bunch of people or something crazy. It was based on a book, and the funny thing is, in the book and the movie also portrayed this black police officer having a conversation over the phone with David Duke. So David Duke had a prominent role in this fictitious portrayal. And of course, if you want the full story, go to davidduke.com. I recommend listening to it for the full story. But, you know, the funny thing is, the police officer who was involved in this wrote a book, and in the book, he actually describes the, some communist group that had a plot to murder David Duke or to crack his skull, and somehow that got twisted by these Jewish Hollywood script writers as a plot by the KKK to murder some black lady. But you know, I guess that's what you call creative license, isn't it?
That certainly is, and it's not something that's uncommon in Hollywood. I always look very carefully when a Hollywood movie says based on a true story, because the important word there is based. So essentially, somewhere there was a kernel of truth. Somewhere there was a little bit of truth that the rest of the story was based upon. So for example, with a film like the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, I remember as a child, well not a child, a sort of a teenager, being rather excited to see this gory film that was meant to be based on a true story. Now, it was slightly based on a true story. It was based on the case of Ed Gein, a man who had committed a rather grisly murder. But before he'd committed this grisly murder, he had been quite notable as a grave robber. He'd taken a number of sort of body parts from local graves and used them to make bizarre items, such as a mask of human flesh, which in itself is quite grisly and would be quite interesting as a documentary or some kind of film, because let's face it, people are quite interested by the grotesque, the macabre. They're quite interested by things that are a little bit different. But when you actually watch the film, The Texas Chainsaw Massacre, you have a sort of a large, overweight man in a mask made of human skin chasing people around with a chainsaw. And he is one of a family of cannibals that basically entrap sort of young college students, massacre them and eat them. And when you actually look at the case of Ed Gein, which the story is loosely based on, when I say loosely, I mean really, really loosely, and you look at the Texas Chainsaw Massacre, the whole based on a true story tag is very, very stretched. It's extremely stretched. In fact, it's stretched to the point where the actual film isn't so far from the reality of what it's based upon, that saying it's based on a true story is almost as fantastical as the tale itself, as what you're seeing on the screen. And with things like this, Hollywood has a way of manipulating the masses, of selling things to the masses in a particular way to make people believe they're seeing something that's true to life, that's a real life story, that's something that is actually true, that's something that's, you know, verifiable. So people look at it and go, oh, wow, based on a true story, well, I'm going to watch this, God. That, and they tell their friends, oh, I've seen something, and it's a real life story. Well, based on a real life story and a real life story are very different things. And it does not shock me one bit to know that someone like Spike Lee would take something, turn it into something completely different, and then say, underneath the title of the film, based on a real life story, because that's kind of the hook that gets people to watch it. Mm-hmm. And the word based is the get out of jail free card so that they don't get sued or get any form of legal action taken against them for, how can I say it, sexing something up and making that something very different to what it actually was, but being able to get the term real life story in the byline.
Right. And of course, at least in the initial advertisements for this movie, it wasn't based on a real life story. It was based on some for real manure, right? And it was manure. I mean, it was some real for real bull manure. So I don't know. So for the all the details, go to Dr. Duke's the website, davidduke.com. It's up there. You'll see it, and you can listen to his explanation of it. He's spoken over the phone to the scriptwriter. He's got the whole story there. You're not going to hear the whole story from the Oscars. Now, last week, though,
Wait a second. I've got to butt in here. I don't like to interject, but did David win an Oscar? That's what we all want.
Well, we all wanted him to go down there and be part of the entourage going up on the stage, right? You know, because he...
I would love to have seen David Duke on the red carpet outside the Oscars saying, where is my award?
Because somehow... he inspired this story, even though it wasn't real life at all. It was some sort of fantasy, but oh well, who knows? I guess he's just such an inspiring character. Well, last week though, Mark, you have your weekly videos.
It did win the best adapted screenplay, though, didn't it?
Very adapted, because it was the biggest stretch, I guess. Right? I mean, it was a massive departure from the book, right?
So it was nominated for 6 Academy. I'm just reading this off Wikipedia. This is, if anyone out there in the audience thinks I'm like the expert on this film, I'm just reading this from Wikipedia. But Black KKK Klansman was nominated for 6 Academy Awards and won Best Adapted Screenplay. Nominations included Best Picture, Lee for Best Director, and Driver for Best Supporting Actor. The film was also nominated for Best Film Editing. Composer Terren Blanchard was also nominated for Best Original Score. Now, I tell you, that's quite good, because David now has essentially been the subject of an Oscar-winning film. That's pretty impressive. I've got to say, you know, he's had a legitimate best-selling book. He's been elected to the House of Representatives in Louisiana, and now he has been the subject of an Oscar-winning film. That is a pretty impressive resume. And
Can we call him a cultural icon?
I think we can. Do you know what I think we should do?
What?
I think we need to get him a replica Oscar, and we need to get him on one of these big streams like with JF or the Kill Stream, and I think we need to get him holding up that Oscar and thanking Spike Lee. Because I'm telling you, if there'd be anything that would annoy Spike Lee and the Academy, it would be Dr. David Duke holding up a replica Oscar.
It doesn't have to be a replica.
I've
got a friend with an Oscar. And those things, I've held it. It's just a clunky piece of metal. I don't know. We could get him a Goyim's Choice Award, and he could hold that. We'll see.
I think we should get him. I'm gonna look on eBay as we speak. I mean, we don't want any dead air, so you're gonna hear me typing. But let's see if How much is a replica Oscar? Let's make this happen.
Yeah,
make this happen.
In
fact, a replica Oscar they're about £45 actually, made from real metal. So not too expensive. We could certainly get him that. Mm-hmm. I'm pretty sure we could get him that. And we could get him, I think there's several different ones. Are they the same every year? Are the Oscars the same? Is a little statue?
No, I think they probably change it a little bit from year to year. I have the feeling. I'm not sure. But I
get a medium one or a large one. We'll have to get him one. I think he deserves it. I think we should troll the Academy, and I think we should troll Spike Lee. In fact, we should troll the whole of Hollywood, and we should make this known. This should be our sort of big 2019 wind up to really get these people angry, because if anything can guarantee you a bit of good publicity, and anything with David in it is usually good publicity, and it's something that draws attention to our movement, is making out like we have benefited from their sort of degeneracy or their madness. And I think we could run with this one.
Okay, that might be fun. Now, you'll notice if you watch the Goyim Choice Awards on the thumbnail for that the YouTube video, I have an Oscar, and then I photoshopped over the face of it the that normie face that, you know, from
the NPC
from Murdoch.
Yeah,
and then I took a giant screw and put it through the Oscar because the Goyim are being screwed. And
that is some very powerful imagery, very well thought out there too.
On the fly. Because you'll hear Professor Sloan ask me about it early on in the show. What does it look like? And I was like, I don't know. And so it just kind of came out in the fly.
I liked it. I was listening to it today. Actually, I listened to the first half today. I was really enjoying it. And I must say, the production values on it are really good. You really did a really good job with the editing and the sound effects. It actually does sound like you guys are in a big amphitheater. I was impressed, Patrick.
Yeah.
I can tell that. Things like that, you really put some heart and soul into it.
Yeah, no,
I suggest everyone, if you haven't listened to this, go to Patrick's YouTube channel. It really is worth listening to.
That took a couple of months, but you know, I'm going to be doing more stuff like that. There's some more stuff I've got up my co-certified sleeves. The co-certified has some very special apps in development, and I have I thought I was doing the beta testing for them, but seeing as Jesse Lee Peterson told me I'm an alpha male, I guess I'm doing the alpha testing, not the beta testing. But there's going to be some good stuff coming out.
Well, that's certainly good to hear, and it's also good to hear that you got the Jesse Lee Peterson stamp of alpha male approval. That is always a good one. I would hate to be one of the people that Jesse exposes as a beta male. He's reduced those beta males to tears on his show. It's epic. It really is like an emotional test for these cuckolds. They are literally reduced to tears as he sits there smirking and saying how amazing it is.
Wow. Well, that was a fun show. And if you want to, I will be replaying portions of that episode from the week before last on your show. I'll be replaying that on this show at some point in the future. So I'm getting that ready.
That was definitely one of the most enjoyable shows we've done, and I recommend that people listen in. And this week we've got some big guests. We've got Henrik and Lana from Red Ice Radio, sort of nationalist royalty, so to speak. You know, the first couple of nationalism, they will be our special guests. Now, if you remember, we had them on quite some time ago when the show was on Breeze Channel. But, I mean, that was absolutely years ago now. I think it was years ago anyway. In fact, if I look at it, yeah, exactly. It was almost exactly a year ago. So February, it was actually just over a year ago, February the 14th, 2018, we had Lana and Henrik on. So just over a year ago now. So they're definitely due for their return. So that'll be a big, big show for anyone that wants to tune in.
Yeah, and that's Wednesday. It does compete with this show, but due to the magic of the co-certified Be in Two Place at One Time app, I'm able to do both shows live, which is great. Okay, now last week you had your weekly podcast, your weekly video, and these are great educational videos because you actually do research into it, and so So it's not just talking off the top of your head. And you, so they're really, I guess, deep dives into particular issues. And you did your deep dive into AIPAC and the power of AIPAC, which, of course, was in the news because our Congresswoman Ilan, what's her name? Ilan Ahmed or something? Ilan, I forgot what her last name is. She represents Somalia in Congress, and she had mentioned that AIPAC was powerful, and the entire political establishment, including Donald Trump, all freaked out, saying, "Oh, she's talking about AIPAC. AIPAC has no power. Oh, that's crazy." So, what did you learn in the course of researching this?
Well, I learned that Ilhan Omar is in fact correct, but she is not only correct. She is so right on the money and probably understating the actual fact of the matter.
She probably doesn't understand the actual fact of the matter.
I think a lot of people don't understand just how powerful AIPAC are. And I also don't think people understand the subversive methods AIPAC use to control Congress and control American politics, because this isn't just a matter of money. This isn't just a matter of huge funding. And it is huge funding. I mean, these guys, you know, the most recent figures I pulled up for AIPAC was their 2014 accounts, and they took over 77 million in a single year. Now, comparing that to the RNC and the DNC, you know, the figures were comparable. I think the DNC that year took about 150, I think maybe 140 something, 140 million, and the RNC took about it was about 165 million. I can bring up the exact figures, but they were certainly comparable. You weren't talking about AIPAC bringing in 10 million and the RNC bringing in 200 million and the DNC bringing in 180 million. You were talking about comparable figures. And for those in the UK, it's important to note that AIPAC raises more in a single year than either of the two main political parties here in the UK. You are talking absolutely huge, huge sums of money. Mm. I've got the exact figures in front of me now. So the DNC, the main fundraising arm of the Democrats, took a total of 168 million in 2014, and the RNC, more or less, you know, just shy of 195 million. Now, AIPAC took over 77 million, and that's from a group of people, Jewish people, who were only account for less than 2% of the population in America. So it shows the vast amount of funds that these people can raise. But the interesting thing is that funding is only the tip of the iceberg.
It really is. Yeah, just the tip of the iceberg. There's a big multiplier effect. So why don't you explain that?
Well, it's important to note that AIPAC isn't the only Israel lobby in America. It's one of several. But secondly, AIPAC has a system of using what are called PACs. Now, I obviously am from the UK, so I wasn't really sure what PACs were. I was like, what's a PAC? Well, a PAC is not what AIPAC is, and that's something that is very important. So for people scratching their head, a PAC is a political action committee. And AIPAC stands for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. Mm-hmm. So what's the difference here? Well,
and we got about 30 seconds.
Okay. Well, I'll explain what PACs are just after this break.
Okay. And so we'll be right back. America-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It's just public affairs, Goyim. What could be wrong with that? And we'll be right back. And we are back. So, what about all of this, this AIPAC only being the tip of the iceberg in terms of money going to, in basically, pro-Jewish, pro-Israel money being funneled into American politics?
Well, as I said, AIPAC stands for the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee. It is not what is known as a PAC. And a PAC is a political action committee, and they're groups which are organized for the purpose of raising and spending money to elect or defeat candidates. Okay, so that's something very different. And these PACs are very, very powerful, they're very, very influential, and they are set up to either endorse or knock down a candidate. Now, AIPAC, the American-Israel Public Affairs Committee, started up what are known as local caucuses in congressional districts with the aim of influencing American politics. Now, these caucuses are not PACs. However, according to a journalist by the name of Connie Brook, who wrote for The New Yorker, she claimed that by the end of the 1980s, dozens of these political action committees, which had no formal relationship with AIPAC, were actually controlled by members of AIPAC. Mm-hmm. So essentially, AIPAC was having this huge influence on both raising and spending money at elections, but without having to declare that money as being affiliated mm-hmm. with AIPAC, because it was being done through AIPAC caucuses, which were controlling a large number of influential political action committees. And again, they didn't have to declare anything.
So AIPAC affiliated people, maybe AIPAC board members, are also on the boards of these other political action committees, this type of overlapping personnel, right? This type of thing.
Yeah. So you've got all these political action committees, which are all meant to be independent, all meant to be fighting for a number of different causes, or, you know, and influencing politics in a number of different ways, are all being controlled and directed by members of AIPAC, who are acting for the good of AIPAC. But because they're running these political action committees, which aren't openly affiliated with AIPAC, they can direct all of this spending, raising and spending money at elections, defeating candidates, electing candidates, and forcing money in a certain direction, but without any of that having to be declared as AIPAC money. So that massively boosts the $77 million we spoke of earlier. And according to Thomas Dine, who was the executive director of AIPAC from 1980 to 1993, the money coming from these AIPAC-controlled political action committees accounted for up to 15% of a typical congressional campaign budget. Mm. So you're talking a huge, huge flow of money being either used to positively or negatively influence American politics.
Yeah, so 15%. Now, here's the thing. So they use money to elect representatives. They use money to defeat representatives. It probably costs more to defeat somebody than it does to elect somebody. But most importantly, they keep everybody quiet, because it's that threat they have, which they've used effectively. They've carried out this threat on a number of occasions to defeat people who step out of line, like Cynthia McKinney, like Charles Percy, like Senator Fulbright, Senator Paul Findlay. That's right. And they've used it often enough that anybody who steps out of line knows they're going to be facing a well-funded opponent. And probably wouldn't be facing, especially in the House of Representatives, typically opponents are not well-funded. And this threat, it's kind of like how one person with a gun, or two or three people with a gun's even better, can take an entire airliner or an entire bank and take the whole 100 people hostage just with, you know, one or two people with a gun, because nobody wants to be that one hero to step out of line and get shot.
Exactly, and that's really the power here, because if you think of their money being spread very, very thinly, you see, the vast majority of politicians are positive towards Israel, support Israel, or at the very least will pay lip service to Israel and vote, in inverted commas, the correct way in Congress. So AIPAC has that power, And the money is spread quite thinly, as we said, between sort of 10-15% of a typical congressional budget. However, if one person steps out of line, if one person decides to buck the trend, all of a sudden, more money can be funneled into that area. And that area becomes a place where the fight is essentially on. And because the money can be concentrated, because only a few people dare step out of line, only a few people have ever dared step out of line, those particular races where an individual has gone against the Israel lobby or gone against AIPAC or said something critical of Israel become areas where AIPAC concentrates their resources, where AIPAC uses every single political action committee that they control, and they ensure the spending is overwhelmingly negative. So a candidate who faces that negative spending simply can't get re-elected.
Yeah, that 15% or so, I mean, even if it's only 5%, that's basically just a reminder to the candidate of the financial power of AIPAC and the Israel lobby, and it's kind of like that pack attack, you know, that wolf pack like attack on the person who steps out of line, and it's really effective. It's especially effective in Congress. We'll be right back. We'll be right back. And we are back, and we're talking about AIPAC. And so, you know, we know about Jewish money and Israel lobby money in presidential elections, and it plays an important part in presidential elections, but it's really, really effective in Congress. And, you know, as cucky as our presidents have been regarding Israel, they're nowhere near as, you know, in lockstep and beholden to Israel as Congress. Nowhere near. I mean, Donald Trump, you can look back at presidents ever since probably Bill Clinton who have talked about moving the embassy to Tel Aviv, I mean, to Jerusalem from Tel Aviv, just as one example. They talked about it. Finally, Donald Trump went and did it after decades of having it been talked about. But every year, Congress would pass these resolutions calling for it, which were, I think, passed near unanimously. Congress is just so much in lockstep, and that's because the ability of AIPAC to flood the coffers of an opponent to anybody who steps out of line, I mean, it's overwhelming because AIPAC, they can mobilize tens of millions of dollars, and tens of millions of dollars in a congressional election is overwhelming. It's not overwhelming it's important in a presidential election, but it's not overwhelming the same way. And so they've got this incredible power. Now, I know there's an Israel lobby in Britain. There's a few. There's like, isn't there the Labour Friends of Israel and some other groups?
Yeah. And how? Every major party has its own Friends of Israel group.
But Jeremy Corbyn in the Labour Party, who may be prime minister sometime before long, he is rather harsh on Israel compared to other politicians. Isn't that the case?
He's quite interesting, is Jeremy Corbyn, because when you say harsh on Israel, it's quite interesting. He's just very honest about Israel in the fact that he is a multiculturalist. He believes largely in open borders. He believes in mass immigration, and he doesn't believe in ethnostates.
And he did not support Brexit, did he?
Well, he said lots of things which were mainly anti the European Union before then voting against Brexit. That was a very interesting decision on his part. But what I will say is that he was someone who was anti-Israel, not for the same reasons that we're anti-Israel, but because he didn't want to support a nation that had essentially an apartheid policy. He didn't want to support a nation that had really first and second class citizens, because he is an ardent supporter of
first and second class citizens and a whole bunch of people it rules over who aren't citizens.
Yes.
And aren't allowed to be citizens of any country.
No, well, exactly. And Jeremy Corbyn was completely against that. He was very much in the camp that suggesting that Israel essentially was carrying out Nazi-style war crimes, or alleged Nazi-style war crimes, should I say, and that, you know, really, Israel was operating these large open-air concentration camps where they regularly shell people, where they regularly abuse you know, other people and deprive them of foreign aid, of clean running water. They bomb hospitals, they bomb schools. And he was very, very critical of Israel as a nation. Now, let me be clear here. Jeremy Corbyn was not critical of Jewish people. Jeremy Corbyn was critical of Zionism and Israel as a nation. However, because of these new international definitions on anti-Semitism, which equate being critical of Israel to being anti-Semitic, and, I mean, you can see this in Europe as well. I mean, Emmanuel Macron is pushing for new laws which will equate being anti-Zionist to being an anti-Semite. So it will now essentially be illegal to make comments critical of Zionism in France. I mean, here's an article. I'm reading this directly. Breaking news: France will define anti-Zionism, a form of anti-Semitism, Macron tells French Jewish groups. So really, he isn't anti-Jewish. He's not somebody who speaks of Jewish power, but he does speak of Israeli power. He does speak of Zionist power, and he does speak of the bias towards Israel in the mainstream Western media. And because of this, it's got him in rather deep water, because he thinks that he is being ideologically coherent. He believes he's speaking, well, he is speaking out for an oppressed minority, and all of a sudden he doesn't understand why speaking out against this oppressed minority would get him targeted by these Zionists. But they've attacked him. You know, he's saying, I'm a good multiculturalist and I want multiculturalism for Israel too, but they're not having that. And this is why he is now facing a split in his party. This is why a number of influential Jewish MPs and very, very pro-Israel MPs have walked out of the Labour Party and created a split and plunged his party into absolute chaos, or one of the reasons anyway. Mm-hmm. There are other more complicated reasons there, which we discussed on my show last Wednesday. But it has landed him in deep water. And now on a daily basis, the papers in the UK, which are obviously all completely pro-Israel, are running endless stories that Jeremy Corbyn is destroying the Labour Party, that he's an anti-Semite, that anti-Semitism is the biggest problem in the Labour Party and in the UK as a whole, that he is fueling a toxic environment of anti-Jewish attitudes, when in fact he's not at all. He's just questioning a foreign state.
Do you think he's in danger of losing his leadership of the Labour Party?
I don't think so. Mm-hmm. I don't think he's in danger of losing it. You see, the reason I don't think he's in danger of losing it is because there's been a split in the party.
Now, and here's one more question. How big is that split? How many people would be leaving the party at the parliamentary level, and how many people would be leaving it at the voter level?
I don't think anyone's really leaving it at the voter level, but at the parliamentary level, I think he's lost 10 MPs now.
And what
it might
are
be
they
nine,
becoming
it might
in,
be 10.
Are they leaving the party and becoming independent? Or
yes, they've formed an independent bloc in Parliament. But the reason these people have jumped is because they didn't have any power in the party. And that's what you've got to remember about any kind of political split. People only split, people only form a new group if they can't hijack the apparatus of the existing party. Because if you've got an existing party that takes in 30, 40 million a year in revenue, has a base in every constituency in the country, has branches, groups, trade union support, and I think about 600,000 members nationwide, you are not walking out of that party to start your own party. Well, not at first anyway. The first thing you're going to try and do is capture that party, carry out a coup against the current leadership, capture the apparatus and machinery of that party, and essentially take it over and oust your opposition. But these people failed. These people did not manage to do that. They failed absolutely dramatically in that endeavor. And because of that, seven of them walked out in one group, then they were joined by an eighth, a ninth, and I believe it might even be 10 now.
And how many of these, if you don't mind me interrupting, how many of these people who've walked out, how many of them are actually Jewish?
A number of them are Jewish. Mm-hmm. And every day the media is just bringing this up more and more. So today in the Mirror, it's nine more. That's a daily paper in the UK. Nine more MPs could quit Labour and join the rebels, making it the third largest party. And they really are trying to, build this up and build this up. And essentially, I'm just Googling this now, number of rebel Labour MPs. So apparently there's nine Labour MPs, there's 11, it's very, very difficult to actually get a...
Okay, well, while you look for that, I have a question, and maybe you can look and listen at the same time, we'll see. So Britain has a somewhat different system than the United States. Usually in the United States, most states have residency requirements for people who are going to represent them in Congress. Even New York, which has a loose requirement, Hillary Clinton was able to just go and buy a house in New York and then run as its senator. But, you know, other states, you typically, you have to live in the district, you have to maybe have spent a certain amount of time in the state or in the district before you run. But in Britain, isn't it very common for, people could all be from London, but you just say, okay, you're going to run in this, what do they call it? Not district, what do you call it? Constituency in Scotland, and you're going to run out of this one.
Constituency.
Yeah, they just, so the people who are running in this or that constituency aren't necessarily people who live there or have any connection to that constituency or have any popularity, and they owe their seat simply to the Labour Party tag on the ballot. Isn't that the case?
Well, that's the thing. Here in the UK, you vote for a candidate, but that candidate is endorsed by a party. So technically, you're not voting for the party, you're voting for the candidate. But effectively, most people vote for a party. So these people, especially one particular member of this group, Luciana Berger, she's Jewish. She stands in Liverpool and Wavertree. And
does she have any connection to Liverpool?
Sorry?
Does she have any connection to Liverpool? Did she grow up there?
I'm not sure. I'm not sure. I've not looked into her extensively. I know she's Jewish, but I know that Liverpool is a Labour hotbed. There is absolutely no way on earth would she ever get elected there if it hadn't been under a Labour banner. People don't vote for Luciana Berger. They vote for the Labour Party. And this is very, very interesting. And this really needs to... this really needs to be sort of hammered home, because these people, one of their demands is they're saying they want a people's vote. And that's just basically a BS term for they want another vote on Brexit. And they're calling it a people's vote to make it sound popular. But you've got to remember, we had a people's vote. We had a people's vote all the way back in 2016, and the people voted to leave. So it's a bit of nonsense, really. But the interesting thing here with this so-called people's vote is none of the MPs who have jumped ship, none of the MPs who have gone independent, are allowing a people's vote in their own constituency. Mm-hmm. None of these people are saying, well, actually, let's have a by-election to see if I'm more popular as an independent than the party that I stood for previously.
And they could resign, and then there would be a by-election. This is something that happens sometimes. Sometimes you'll have a number of people resign to force a by-election to show the people's will, right? This is something that's done in Britain. It's not really done in America.
Yes, exactly. That's exactly what happens. But instead of them doing this, instead of them holding these by-elections, there is absolutely there's absolutely no by-elections being held. These people are not in any way trying to see if they're actually popular as independents. In fact, quite the opposite. They are now doing their best to say, oh, well, we want a people's vote over Brexit. We want a rerun of Brexit, but we do not want to actually see if the voters want us as independents. And this is one of the great hypocrisies of this sort of gang of independents, because they want democracy, or not really democracy, they want another sort of crack of the whip. And to be fair, holding a people's vote on Brexit, as they call it, a people's vote, would be very, very bad. It would actually be spitting in the face of the democratic process, because we've already had a vote on that. Mm-hmm. However, these people have never, ever been elected as independents. These people have not got an actual, these people haven't got a mandate as independents. And that's the important thing to remember. Mm-hmm. They don't have a mandate. They haven't gained a mandate. And they're not about to. Because they're not going to give people the chance. There's going to be no people's vote on those independents.
And I know that support for Brexit was mixed, both in the Labour Party and in the Tory Party. You had pro and anti in both parties, at least at the parliamentary level. These nine defectors from the rebels from the Labour Party, Do you know if they are mostly people who had opposed Brexit, or there's some people who had supported Brexit in there? We know that there's a fair number of Jewish individuals.
They're all people who opposed Brexit.
They all opposed Brexit.
They all opposed. The two things that unite these people is an opposition to Brexit and a absolutely pro Israel
stance. So they opposed Brexit, but they didn't resign, or they didn't leave the party over Brexit. They're leaving the party over the Israel position of Jeremy Corbyn.
It's the Israel position, and they are saying that they are going to be a pro-European, they are a pro-European, anti-Brexit party. They are, and that's one of their key things. Well, they're not a party, they're a group in Parliament. They've not formed an actual formal party yet. But they are saying one of their key demands is they want a people's vote on Brexit, but not a people's vote on their particular constituencies.
Okay. Well, we'll see how that goes, but... because, so, okay, and are there any prospects for elections coming anytime soon in Britain? I know they don't have to be held for, like, another, what, 3.5 years or 4 years or so?
There will be local council elections this year in certain parts of the country, but there will not be a general election. In fact, the next significant date in the calendar, in the UK calendar, as far as politics go, is Friday the 29th of March, which isn't actually far off. And that is the date we are meant to leave the European Union. Mm. But don't hold your breath, because there is still a month to go, and we will see how that all plays out. Because if rumours are to be believed, Theresa May could well be moving with a group of people to delay Brexit. There is a pressure on her now to do so. She has delayed the vote on Brexit, and it could lead to a delay in us leaving. So that's a wait and see moment.
Mm-hmm. And if Theresa May, for instance, if she felt that events unfolded in such a way that she would do well in general elections, she could call general elections at any time, right?
No, she can't. There's an issue now called the Fix Parliament Act. So it used to be down to a Prime Minister to call a general election. Okay. A Prime Minister could call...
Can you tell us that after the break? I'm sorry. We'll be right back. And we are back. And just before the break, I was having my own misunderstanding being explained. So it's the case that a British Prime Minister can no longer just call elections anytime they feel that the political winds are blowing in their direction. Is that the case?
Exactly. British Prime Minister now has to, well, there's the Fixed Parliament Act, which means there are general elections on fixed dates. But if people want to, if a Prime Minister wanted to call a general election before that fixed date, the Prime Minister would have to go to Parliament, push a vote through Parliament, and Parliament would have to vote that a general election was in the interests of the public.
So it requires a majority vote in Parliament.
Yes, because before it was the Prime Minister's will, but now, due to the Fixed Parliament Act, that is not the case anymore. So what you can't essentially see is a Prime Minister getting elected, not having a large enough majority, and instantly taking the country back to a second election, which has happened in the past.
It's happened in the past, and it happens in other countries. It's not unusual in other countries. Okay, well, that's very interesting. I wasn't aware of that development.
Interesting, because essentially Theresa May did force through an early general election, but that backfired on her catastrophically. She lost her a majority in Parliament,
and she got the majority vote in Parliament for permission to hold the early general elections. Is that what
happened? and then took a bit of a thrashing in that general election, lost a majority, and had to form a coalition government with the DUP, which was of course very, very embarrassing for her.
Okay, so her, at the time, the Conservatives, the Tories, had a substantial majority in Parliament, and so they were willing to go along with her request for early general elections. So if the Prime Minister and the party, and her party, or ruling coalition, feel that they're going to do well, they can have early general elections. But the Prime Minister can no longer go over the heads of her own party and call elections or something like that. All right. Well, as a political scientist, I'm interested in this type of thing. Okay, in the last couple of minutes, I just want to know, so Brexit is supposed to come up in just a few weeks. It's supposed to take place in March. You're supposed to leave the European Union. What if it doesn't happen? What's going to happen? What will the political developments be then?
Well, I think it'll be a very interesting time. You see, if we've never had this before, we've never had such a referendum like this, and we've never had a referendum that the government have essentially made noises that they want to block the result of. And I think it'd be a very, very dangerous change in UK politics if the government blocked Brexit or delayed it, because I think it would signal to 17.4 million people that democracy was dead in the UK, that democracy only mattered when the government and the establishment got the result they wanted. Now, I believe that anyway, but I think there's a lot of people who still hold a lot of hope, or they still have a lot of faith in the democratic system. And I think if they delay Brexit, I think if they put Brexit off, I think if they try to formally block it, you see, they've tried lots of sneaky things before, but now it's getting very late. And I think if they'd have managed to block it through some bizarre legal challenge from a left-wing group, that would have caused a lot of problems, but not nearly as many problems as if Parliament itself, elected representatives tried to block it. And I think it could well lead to a complete reshaping and redrawing of political boundaries in the UK.
Is it possible that some pro-Brexit Tories, like Boris Johnson, would split with the government?
Yeah, I think it could cause numerous other splits, and essentially it could see the crumbling of the old political parties, the old political establishment, and almost, if you like, the redrawing of the political map here in the UK.
Well, we'll keep an eye on that. Thank you so much for joining the show again. We look forward to having you back next Monday, and please join us on Wednesday on Mark Collett's YouTube channel.
Thank you very much.
And I'll be back again tomorrow with another exciting episode of National Bugle Radio.